At INCO, he puts the knowledge to work as a general manager, continually striving to keep INCO at the forefront of the digital audio delivery software industry. Patrick Campion.
Thanks, Heath. Hi, everybody. My name is Patrick Campion. I work for INCO Systems. I'm assuming most of you in the room know who we are and what we do, but I'll give you the brief two-minute spiel as a background. INCO has been around since 1983. In 1991, we switched focus from industrial automation and process control into radio automation primarily. Originally, we were going to do TV process control, but there wasn't as much need there as there was for basic audio playout and audio automation. So in 91, we switched to that, and then 92, we sold our first system. So we're 20 and a half years now of sending out automation systems and audio playout systems to radio stations all over the globe. Because of the broad nature of how our back end works, we're used by a lot of non-traditional facilities too, stadiums, TV stations, Monday night football trucks. So we do a lot more than just that. It's basically anywhere audio is needed, we have a presence. My name is Patrick Campion. Again, I'm the general manager at INCO. I originally started there in 1999. I came in out of radio kind of green and started in tech support and in software testing and have spent the last 13 years basically staring at an automation system screen every day of my life. I ran my own business for a while doing a consultant business where I was installing automation systems. I have, on my own, with INCO as well, probably been, I think I've been to 44 states now, and what Keith said is true. I have been to hundreds of radio facilities, trained literally thousands of people on how to use this stuff, and that's all an introduction into why we do what we do. And what you see behind me, it comes out of why we do what we do, which is trying to stay on the forefront of technology in the radio business. What are automation systems going to do next? What are people going to want to do next in their automation IT environment? What's going to make your lives easier as we progress forward with technology and whatnot? So what I'm going to talk about today kind of falls into a couple different pieces. One is we look at the histrionics of how we got to the build out or the environment that I'm going to talk about today. We look at the last 20 years. How automation has progressed, what other key components in the world of broadcast IT and audio delivery have come into play to allow us to get to where we're at today. And then I talk in very specific detail about how we're building this environment that I'm going to talk about and how we're delivering it and how we've been adapting it over the last 10 years for different purposes. So a really long title for this is Virtual Environments and Radio Automation, the kitschy, catchy one that I give to people who are choosing whether or not to do a presentation is Create Your Own Cloud, because it sounds all modern and happy and new anytime you use the word cloud. I think last year at NAB I presented it as something like a green approach to automation because they were really big on the green prospect of it. But essentially what it breaks down to is what we're going to look at is how to do VM environments with an automation system, a radio automation system specifically. So taking all those computers that are in racks or in studios all over your facility with all the sound cards and the GPI cards and all that, and breaking it down to where it all lives inside of a single or a pair of servers. So what is your traditional automation environment? And like I said, I've only been doing this since 1999. Automation systems, regardless of what certain patent holders might say, have been around since the late 80s, not since 1994. The basic components of an automation system really haven't changed that much in that last 25-year cycle. It's primarily a one-to-one architecture. Everywhere you need a studio interface, a GUI interface for an automation system, you need some sort of workstation. And that workstation is going to have a bunch of different components in it. And traditionally, we like to do these as 4U rack mount cases, although people do mid-towers, people do 1Us, 2Us, 3Us. But the 4Us accommodate a larger power supply, a hot swappable redundant power supply if you're smart, a nice big server class motherboard, a whole bunch of RAM, those nice hot, fast, loud processors and their accompanying fans, a big old honking audio card, which also generates a lot of heat, the GPIO card, either an internal PCI, an external serial, or an external USB, some sort of serial interface if you're controlling RS-232 or RS-422 devices, you know, so on and so forth. You need a lot of components to make an automation system work. So you take those big honking boxes and all their components, and you stick them somewhere. You're going to put them in a rack room. That means you have to devote a space in your facility, HVAC loads, power conditioning, UPS, and so on, to each one of those machines and those servers. If they're in that rack room, you have to accommodate KVM wiring. You have to do a Cat 5 or Cat 6 or dual Cat 5 pass-throughs from that room into your studio so you can see what you're controlling back in the main server room. You have to do all of your audio wiring. Part of what we're going to be talking about today is how that's changed with the advent of IP audio and audio engines, and how audio wiring has really become a lot simpler over the last 20 years. But in the beginning, again, we have those octopus cables that everybody loves, those big old XLRs hanging off the backs of the machines. I can't tell you how many digigram cards we've replaced over the years where people kick that XLR cable and it yanks the back end of the digigram card out of the machine. The AC, we already talked about power loads, their power legs, differentiating for the different sides of the redundant power supplies, your UPS needs, your relay wiring, so your relay closures from your satellites, and again, that's something that's changed over the years, and your network infrastructure, your network wiring, because these things need their own network environment. And even in a really small environment, a traditional environment, this is a little peer-to-peer, where they both happen to be running into the same studio. This is a one studio with two workstations in it. There's a lot that goes in here. I mean, there's a lot of GPI wiring. There's a lot of audio wiring. There's a lot of power. There's a lot of Ethernet. Just for this little tiny simple example, this is a couple days worth of work to get this into your infrastructure. Even when you expand it just slightly. Now, this is three workstations plus a NAS and tying it into a house network with a couple of broadcast tool switchers going into two consoles. I've almost tripled the amount of work just to go to this level of complexity. And these, again, are really, really simple, basic examples of how to install an automation system, how the planning goes into integrating this into your plant. And I'm sure it's stuff that you guys have done many, many times. So you all have seen diagrams from us or other companies like this, and then you have to figure out how to fit this into your plant. And we've seen some creative examples of how to make that work. Part of what we're going to discuss today is how to fit this automation system into an infrastructure that wasn't built for it. We encounter this all the time. Places where there is simply no IT infrastructure at all. You're in a 50-year-old building. Mike can attest to the plant I used to work at for Salem in Eagan in Minnesota was built by NPR, 50, 60 years ago as a shack in a field, and it now houses three AM stations and a whole staff of people and all the infrastructure that goes into those things when it was really built for a single station and really kind of as a standalone facility with not a lot of people working on it. I could tell you the pains we went through to try and find room for these kinds of things in that facility were pretty immense. This is a job we just did in Guam. They built out a little cabinet and used this nice little UPS, I think they bought it at Walmart, to go along with our rack mount machines that aren't really rack mount. I guess when you don't have a rack, you just kind of creatively set them on a shelf and then one rack mounts the other, but we see that a lot. This is in a hall at an older AM facility where they've chopped into the plaster to put in a rack and built us into their existing infrastructure. What you can't see is on the back end of this, all those machines are sticking out the back because they're built in racks that don't accommodate longer rack mount boxes. Even in facilities where, don't skip that one there, nope, don't. I swear I'm not hitting the button more than once. Hey, there we go. Even in facilities where they have a lot of machines and they have an IT infrastructure that'll accommodate it, these things take up a lot of space. This is, I think, 13 workstations and a couple of servers in a facility in New York. And they've got two whole racks devoted to just this system, even with the smaller footprint of the 1U workstations. So it's still, even with a smaller workstation footprint like the 1U's, it still takes up a lot of space. And that doesn't mean that you don't have to accommodate all the wiring needs. We see this kind of stuff a lot, like the old punch blocks in the background and the generations of wiring kind of hanging out of the ceiling and then shoving our computer into an old telco rack that wasn't really designed to hold this gear, the stuff kind of laying on top of it. So this is the back end of those 1U boxes, the wiring environment in there. I think they have something like 13,000 individual cable runs in this IT plant for this facility. And the point is, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of man hours. It's a lot of time. It's a lot of money spent on making this stuff go. We are expected to deal with this kind of stuff too. It's like put an IT or an automation system into that. In this case in Texas, I think BroadcastWorks ended up taking a hacksaw and just going along the back of that and taking it all out and starting from scratch because they discovered it was easier. We had a fire in here too. Somebody had mounted a wall receptacle at some point without a box into a wall, just nailed it right into a 2x4, so when we plugged a plug into it, it shorted into the 2x4 and started the wall on fire. And, you know, so we see this all the time. When our guys go out on site, I have them take pictures like this for this purpose, so we could kind of, when the client comes back and says, well, you know, you're having this issue, that issue, it's like, well, did you ever fix that clump of massive stuff? Or are you having GPI issues? Great. Well, that was what you're using for your crossover between your different GPI relays, and it's laying on top of a bunch of XLRs. Is it possible it's shorting into something there? You know, those kinds of things. So that's the environment we all live in, and that's the environment that we're expected to install systems in. And engineers ask us, how can you make this easier for us? And that's part of why I'm here today to talk about what we're talking about. A massive piece of this is audio infrastructure. All those cross connects between all your different studios, all those analog or AES connectors, all your DAs between your different places that you need to get audio. The same satellite receiver needs to go into 4 different studios. The output of a console needs to go to 16 different places. I mean, it's not very rare that a single output of something goes to a single place. There are people in the forefront of this, again, going back several years, and I have at Logitech and SAS up here because one of my first jobs at ENCO in 1999 was I got handed a Remora Surface and a Logitech audio engine with no documentation, and they said, make this work. And I had to backwards engineer how the RS-232 hex strings were coming out of that audio engine and being passed to the control surface in order to create things inside of our world that could send data back to it to control it. But the really neat thing about it was, after all these years of working in radio and having, you know, taken off the tops of consoles to put in all that analog audio wiring, there was a single cable going to the back of that surface. There was a single serial cable and a single power cable, and that was it. That was all that went to the back of that console. And I was in love with the thing because I thought, how much easier would this be to put into a studio? And really, the brains behind that, what made that happen, and along with a bunch of other companies that were doing it, and we did a similar thing with SAS, with the early versions of the Rubicon stuff, was that everything lived in that engine. And it could be shared in multiple places simultaneously via what really wasn't networking, but was a fiber-based sharing protocol within the Logitech audio engine network environment. And it made our lives easier because we didn't need to have a one-to-one for every audio card in the system that wanted to record station X or source X. It didn't need to be wired to every single workstation that needed it. Every workstation could access it if it was anywhere in that Logitech environment. So right off the bat, we eliminate the need for a one-to-one audio wiring scenario. But you still had to have sound cards. Still had to have analog or AES sound cards in those workstations to accommodate that environment. And the control protocol at that point was all serial-based. Something else that Logitech did too that was really important and led to a lot of other developments down the road was they incorporated GPIO control into that environment a few years later. Before the advent of IP audio and layer 3 audio over Ethernet from folks like LiveWire and Axia, and then eventually Wheatnet over the years, and Digigram's VisiBlue protocol, and the other ones which don't really exist but they tell you they do. before all that happened, people like Logitech and SAS were doing control protocol via Ethernet. And that was really important too, because if you want to eliminate GPIO cards out of your workstations, you have to have a way to gather control data from your receivers, from your automation system, from your consoles by hitting an on button. If you wanted to do something, you have to have a way to react to it. And for 20 years, that meant you had to have a relay control device, receptor, some sort of thing to receive those isolated relays in your workstations, another piece of hardware. So we could eliminate that, again, with monitoring of a control protocol via serial and eventually via Ethernet within those environments. And then IP audio came along. And IP audio, even in its infancy, the first most clear benefit of this was you don't need audio cards anymore. Realistically, you still sometimes do, but really you don't need audio cards anymore within this environment. And it's a lot more important than that too, because even in an audio engine environment, you have some limitations. You have to have some sort of physical connection between point A and point B. Even if it's within an audio engine, if it's a fiber connect, or if it's a Wheatstone 32KD, or if it's an old SAS audio routing engine, there's still some kind of physical connection. And there's limitations, again, within that world. There's only so many times you could take input A and send it out to B, C, D, E, and F, you know, so simultaneously. One of the great advantages of an IP audio environment, besides the fact that you lose your sound cards, is everything is everywhere simultaneously. Anything that's in that cloud is available everywhere else in that cloud simultaneously. And that was a big part of what got us thinking along the lines of, what do people want to do more with an automation system than anything else going into the next generation? And what we hear from people all the time is, I want to be able to do anything from anywhere. I want to make any studio control for any station, or any other studio control for, or multiple simultaneously, or even offsite. And realistically, to do that simply and easily without a bunch of wiring and a bunch of control data and a bunch of other things is you put it all into this IP audio cloud, where any surface can control anything and any machine can send any audio to anywhere simultaneously. And we have a lot of people that do that, but still within this one-to-one environment of workstations per studio. So how do you branch that into the next level? How do you get rid of the workstations? Because we've gotten rid of the sound cards. We've gotten rid of the serial protocol devices. We've gotten rid of the GPIO interfaces. The last thing we need to get rid of now is workstations. And that's really a step that I don't think anybody in this room has taken, and not many people in the world of broadcast automation, IT, have done. Now, it's really common everywhere else in the world. And banking people have been doing it since the 70s. I mean, dumb terminals from IBM, were in banks, you know, before people had any notion of what a PC was going to be. So VM is not new to the world of IT, but it is very, very uncommon in the world of broadcast IT. And a lot of what I just mentioned is reasons for that. People rely still on those sound cards or those GPIO cards or so many other control mechanisms, and they have to have machines to tap into that, or they just don't plain trust that putting 12 studios into a single server is the best idea. Any engineer who's asked for a redundancy plan, the first thing they're going to tell you is you need to have more than one PC for 12 studios. It just makes common sense, because PCs die all the time. We spend half of our lives now replacing power supplies and hard drives and everything you could think of out of a machine, because they just, over time, die. They're made to run 24/7. So about 10, 11 years ago, we hooked up with a company called Marathon. And what we asked them was, how do we get a level of redundancy back into this system that is necessary for the highest level of broadcasters? And at that time, we were really only focused on servers. How do you take two servers and make it so that they look to the network as if they're one? And that's not a new idea, again. Everybody who's done Novell installations knew what Vinca pairs were and SFT pairs were back in the day. But there really wasn't, without clustering or getting to a really high-end environment in the Windows Server environment, there wasn't a clear one-to-one of how that simple those environments were in the Novell days. And Marathon had a software called Everrun, Everrun MX. And basically, and I'm going to go into more specifics of this, what they do is they take two physical servers, they put virtual server environments on both of them, and they mirror them together. And they hook them up via Ethernet instead of via fiber link cable like the old SFT links. And everything that happens on one is happening on the other simultaneously. And we started installing those things out there in the real world. But since it was $50,000 per server pair just for the license, it wasn't really applicable to a normal broadcast IT environment. That's an entire automation environment for most of the people we, or a budget for most of the people we deal with these days. So it just wasn't applicable to most people in those ways. Now, as time goes by and everything else in the IT world gets cheaper, so did they. And I'll just give you a basic little glimpse into how their world works. They divide the servers up into three basic sections. You have your VM sessions. So in our case, we're in these, the applications we pushed out to the world, we're building a VM server, and it's mirrored from one server to the other. There's an availability manager, which is the actual Marathon software, the Everrun MX, that lives inside of each server. And then there's the component virtualization, which is shared storage and shared network devices within the servers. And you run three different networks. You run a availability link, which is a 2 to 10 gigabit link between the two to keep them in sync down to processor read writes, or processor cycles and RAM read writes. And then it also keeps track of all the storage activity and network activity. And then you have a production network, which is what we would call your automation network, and then a management network. So you have another machine that taps back into this thing like any other VM system. You have a browser-based front end to view what this system is doing. So that's how that works. And I'll go in more detail on this. I know I'm kind of moving quickly by it, but we go into more detail when we talk about how this works. So we took all these different ideas. We took IP audio, we took component virtualization for the control protocols with the GPIO, we took VM servers that we'd been doing, we took the redundancy, because that is a really, really important piece of this. You have to have a high level of redundancy here if you're going to trust that many things into one basket. And we put it all together and made a complete automation system, all VM server-based within a single pair of two rack unit servers. So that's kind of the idea here, is we could take 10 or 12 or 20 workstations and servers and replace that giant mess with a whole lot less than that. And that's what we ended up with. And so you're really clever here, because we replaced the Dell logo with our logo, so you never know that they're Dell servers. But at NAB this year, we showed those two servers were running our entire booth. Every automation front end, every GUI within our booth was running off of that pair of servers. We had 8 individual workstations and a pair of other servers running just off that pair of two rack unit Dell servers. So how do we build this? This is actually something we have a lot of experience with. Going back, again, over these years, we've done doing it on a server level. And to add the VMs for the workstation, it just means we have to add more hardware into the server. We take two identical servers. It's very, very important. They have to be 100% completely identical between the two. We specify the number of cores of processors, the amount of RAM, and the number of NICs depending on your load. So for example, if you're going to do 10 seats in this world, you're probably going to need, we can do up to 4 Xeon processors. So let's say we do 10 seats, we want 4 6 core Intel Xeon processors, which would give us 48 cores with the hyper-threading, probably 32 gig of RAM at a minimum, and depending on whether you're doing how much IP audio you're doing, 8,000 TX NICs on the two servers. There's a really easy formula to get there, but off the top of my head, that's the basics. Essentially, what we want to do is devote 2 cores minimum per workstation and 3 cores minimum per server, 2 gig, preferably 4 gig minimum per workstation, and 4 gig, preferably 6 or 8 gig minimum RAM per server within the environment. And each seat, when I mean that, I mean a studio is a seat and a server is a seat. So those 10 would be 9 studios plus the individual server. And then the number of NICs depends on what exactly, how much load you're putting on this thing, and how much IP audio you're streaming across the network. The more IP audio you need, the more NICs you need within there. I think the most we've spec'd on one of these is 16 individual 1,000 TX NICs. So then we take those two servers, we get them as shells, just drives in a enclosure. I still am talking about this based on the Dell PowerEdge R710s, even though they're end of life. We've now moved into the R720s, which is an 8-drive chassis. Everything we've done up to this point has been in a 6-drive chassis. So we take two of those drives, we build them into a RAID 1. That's where all of my OS and all my VM environments are going to go. All of my component virtualization, everything's going into that RAID 1. And then we build the other 4 drives into a RAID 5 without a hot spare. Don't need a hot standby drive in this environment. And that's going to be my shared storage volume. So assuming, again, that we're using 600 gig SAS drives, do not do this with SATA drives. I know you save a few bucks there, but it's absolutely not worth the performance hit you take from moving to SAS to SATA. So I've got 600 gig, 15,000 RPM SAS drives in the front end of this thing. I can do a 1.8 terabyte volume for my data and audio, and in the new 8-drive chassis with the 6 drives, I could do 3 terabyte volume within my my shared storage volume for all my audio and data, which would accommodate the needs of pretty much everybody except for a few eclectic music stations or classical or jazz stations out there in the world of audio automation. 3 terabytes is more than enough storage space for an environment. So then we take those two and we put them together. And in effect, what you end up with, it's kind of like a RAID 10 and a RAID 50, even though it really truly isn't, because they're not hardware interconnects through the same controller, which is the definition of a RAID 10 or RAID 50. They're Ethernet availability link connected, but it's kind of like what you end up with is a RAID 10 and a RAID 50, because you have 2 RAID 1s and 2 RAID 5s, again, duplicated amongst the two servers. We go to the first server, and we put Citrix Zen Center on it, or Citrix Zen Server, sorry. And I get a lot of questions. The first question we always get is, why do you use Dell? It's like, well, we've been a Dell house for, 12 plus years since we stopped building our own Windows Gamma Array servers and moved into Dell's off of Novell previous to that. We've just been a Dell house, and we like Dell, and we know Dell, that's why we use Dell. I don't have a personal preference for Dell. We can do this. We've done this with HP servers, but just Dell is the one we've done R&D with, so that's the environment I'm familiar with. I get to ask the same question, why do you use Citrix Zen Server instead of Hyper-V or one of the other VM type choices out there? And again, it's the same answer. When we started doing this with Marathon 10 years ago, the only environment they supported was Citrix Zen Server, so that's what we've always done, and it's just what we know best. They support other environments as well, but that's what we build the server is a Citrix Zen Server. We define within there what our environments are going to be, how many server environments we're going to have, how many workstation environments we're going to have, and then we define for those, once we put the Marathon software in there, we define what level of redundancy is going to exist between these two servers for those environments. And we have three different choices. And I always like to refer to them as levels 1, 2, and 3. And again, this comes out of the Novell SFT pair days, where you had three different choices for SFT 1, 2, or 3, where 3 is the highest level of redundancy, 2 is lower, and 1 is lower than that. And the levels of redundancy are an aggregate file backup, that's level 1, a near real-time file level backup, which is level 2, or snapshot servers, that's level 2. And then level 3 is full-on everything is duplicated down to, again, processor cycles and RAM read writes. And we'll talk about what exactly that means in an IP audio environment in just a moment. So we define, like a basic production workstation in a rarely used VTE place, you don't have to allocate all these resources to have it backed up in real time. It's just not necessary. But an on-air workstation or a server, you probably want that backed up in real time. And what that means within this server environment is that you can take the power off of one of the servers and nothing happens. All the workstations, all those people sitting in front of these GUIs in the studios, it just keeps humming along. We've tested this with 100 simultaneous IP audio streams running in this world, and you pull the power off of one or you disconnect the drive out of the front of a cage and it just keeps humming along. With the 100 audio streams, I think we had a quarter second dropout when we disconnected the power off of one server. But for the user front end in that GUI, if you're a level 3 redundancy, there's no perceivable difference between running on two servers or running on one. And the really, really cool thing about this, and this again coming back from my Novell days, is when you plug that first server back in and it goes to rebuild that backup to what is now the backup, what used to be the primary is now the backup, you again take no performance hit. And that's really important because I can't tell you how many times we went out and somebody lost half of an SFT pair and you plug it back in and it starts rebuilding the RAID, and if you can stream one audio stream off that server, you're really, really lucky because it's hammering the performance of that server while it's rebuilding that array back over to the primary server. And God forbid you bring them up in the wrong order and you back up the blank server over to what is your good copy of data, which we've had happen back in the day in the SFT base days. And that, again, is something they overcame in this Marathon software environment, is you can't do that either. There's really not a primary, there's really not a backup. There's an A and a B. And you have three levels. You have a green, a yellow, and a red. And green for both means, hey, we're both up and we're both happy. Green for one, yellow for one means that, hey, there's an issue over here. And green and red means that one of them is dead. And its job is to monitor the data and what it needs to do to maintain it so that it is green at both times on both servers. So if a green and a red, and you bring the red back up, it's going to go, oh, I was red, now I need to get green, so I'm going to have to go over to this guy and get whatever's changed since the last time I came up. And it knows how to do that vice versa. So again, there's not really a primary and a secondary. And in the network, it only sees one server anyways. Your physical, two physical servers are seen as one VM server, Windows Server 2008 anyhow. And when I say high-performance virtual environments, for the workstations, we're going to do Windows 7 Pro 64-bit, and the servers are going to be Windows Server 2008. And this bears mentioning, too, at this point, at the workstation level, at the user interactivity level, they see no difference. They don't know the difference between a Cat5 extender into a room with a KVM extender that they're attaching back to a physical workstation in a rack room versus what we're doing, which is a thin client sitting in a studio, which is running an RDP session back to a server. as far as the visual interaction, the interactivity, the software front end of it, it's all the same to the user. So your users don't experience the system differently. It's up to you to know the difference, and that is in the amount of joy that goes into maintaining and installing these systems. And the Citrix Zen Center is their browser front end. So this is where you'd link back into this thing and you'd see the health of your RAID arrays. You'd see the health of the individual VMs, the status of all of them. You can monitor all the VMs from a central point within that Citrix Zen Center. And then again, we talked about, we use these little WISE terminals. And I'll talk, when I'm talking about the advantages of what the system brings to the table, one of them definitely is these little WISE terminals, which are like $300, and they're little throwaway boxes. But the beauty of this whole thing being attachable via RDP is, if that thin terminal for some reason blows up, you just turn to your email machine or your internet machine sitting right next to it and start up an RDP session and connect back to the session you were just in. You don't have to have the thin clients to get into this. You just have to have something that's capable of running RDP. So Linux boxes, Macs, PCs. I mean, the thin client essentially is just a little Linux box anyhow. And then, again, what's at the heart of this is this server running in lockstep sync. Again, down to processor cycles and RAM rewrites. And that's really important because this component virtualization, this bottom little piece here, that component virtualization in an IP audio environment is really, really important because all your audio is essentially streaming as bits through NICs. And if those things aren't mirrored one to the other, it doesn't work when one side fails over. If it's only coming out of one set of NICs, it doesn't work real well if that server goes away. So that component virtualization piece of it, which again comes down to the processor, the RAM, and then the components that are tied in the machine like USB and Ethernet, are being mirrored one to the other as well. So what do you gain when you go to a system like this? Obviously, the first and foremost thing is a much smaller footprint within your environment. A 4U rack mount system with a switch, if applicable, is obviously smaller than pretty much anything out there where the system makes sense. It doesn't make sense for a 2 or 3 or 4 studio install. It makes sense when you have 8 machines or 10 machines or something along those lines. You can replace all of those components, all that workstation, all that wiring with just 2 servers and a switch. The servers are probably there already. You know, most places we go to talk to them about this, they already have a pair of servers or a single server. So they're already accommodating the UPS need, the HVAC need, the power needs for those servers, and they're just going to eliminate everything else out of the mix. Less power conditioning. I didn't hit it. There we go. Less power conditioning, less HVAC load. Where we like to do specs for this, what's really cool is when you're building a new plant. And it happens more in public radio, it seems, than other places lately. But when you can go into and they say, okay, here's my IT infrastructure in version A and my IT infrastructure in version B. And version A is 13 workstations and 2 servers and the racks needed and the interact cooling and the HVAC needed in that room to cool all that stuff down and the you know, amount of BTUs and the power draw of that HVAC. And then version B and the infrastructure cost of installing all that stuff. And then version B is 2 servers and a switch, and eliminating 2 racks out of that, and eliminating the inter-rack cooling out of that, and eliminating half of that HVAC load out of that room, and all the power needed to push through that. You can almost pay for a system like this with the amount of money they just saved in going to that model of a build. Obviously, it's much easier to integrate. Even in a plant where you're currently analog or AES, you can push this stuff into it by just adding in one extra component, and that is either like an Axia IP audio node or a Wheatstone blade, depending on which IP audio driver you want to use. And you think about it right now, all your workstations are branching out to some sort of, if you don't have IP audio, you're coming out to some sort of breakout panel, either an RJ45 or an XLR or something along those lines. And that's going into your environment. Well, the IP audio nodes and blades are the same exact thing. They're XLR, they're RJ45, and that's branched, you just jump from that into your environment. So it's Cat5 cable from a switch into an IP audio node, you jump that into your environment, you've got IP audio into your existing analog or AES environment. And you've gained a whole lot right in that world right away because you don't have to wire every single thing from your existing environment to 7 different places in your automation system. You have to wire it once. If you're using XDS receivers or your Content Depot receivers, I don't think the current generation of Ambos receivers have it, but they have Axie IP Audio built into them. So you just plug that into that environment. Now all of your satellite and your control mechanisms are available everywhere simultaneously. I don't know that most people know this, but those XDS receivers and the Content Depot receivers, in addition to sending out control physical relay closures, send out a UDP multicast of XML formatted data every time a relay closure comes in that we can capture and react to just as if it was a regular relay closure. So all of that control data, all that audio already exists inside of your environment if you go to something like this. Obviously the servers we're using, even though we're not using crap for the workstations by any stretch of the imagination, servers, especially from Dell with their wonderful Next Business Day replacement of all the parts inside of them, are much higher quality materials. A lot of RF guys and broadcast engineers spend an awful lot of time replacing hard drives and power supplies and motherboards and video cards and sound cards and all the components that go into these things that are failing all the time. And less moving parts and the higher quality materials leads to that easier maintenance. And scalability is great too. At the NAB show this year, somebody said, well, how do you add a workstation? So you go into Citrix Zen Center and you say, I want to duplicate this environment right here. You click on it and it says, okay, duplicating, done. What would you like to name it? You name it and that's it. You now have six workstations instead of five. Literally within a few minutes, you can expand your system out to include extra workstations as opposed to ordering a machine and a sound card and wiring it into your environment and doing all the components and blah, 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 blah to go into it. You just duplicate an environment, and there you go. You've got a whole new system. So you buy a station, you want to put in a new production studio, you're a few minutes to do that inside of this environment. The fault tolerance, you know, I don't think I've experienced in my life anything that is as fault tolerant as this system. There are a lot of things that exist in the broadcast IT world for automation especially to give you very good levels of redundancy. Automatic failovers, full-on server disaster recovery scenarios, things of that nature. Nothing can take the abuse that pulling completely the power off of one side of your entire half of your system and not missing a beat and going forward with your broadcast day without the operators being aware of it like this system can. There's a fault tolerance that exists here that doesn't really exist anywhere else. And you got to keep in mind, too, that this replaces a KVM system. It gives you the functionality of what is a really high-end IP KVM system because everything's available, every studio that has a thin client or has the availability to run an RDP session simultaneously. So you're talking like an Avascent, like an HMX type system, a $20,000 KVM system, you've replaced with a bunch of little thin clients and single Cat 5 runs to the studios. It's important to consider, too, when you're looking at the expense of upgrading an automation system of what are you going to need to tap into your current environment with these new machines. A lot of people, we get these machines, they're DVI now, so you need DVI to VGA adapters. There's no PS2 ports, and all of your KVM extenders are PS2 and VGA only. So you have to accommodate whether or not the machines they're shipping you are going to work with a USB to PS2 adapter into that environment, whether the KVM extenders will work. And I've been places, I kid you not, where they have six extenders, and three of them work with USB to PS2 adapters, and three of them don't. And if you can tell me why those exact same six work, half the time, it's like a toss-up. So then you end up having to replace your KVM extender. So all that stuff gets thrown into this mix when we talk about this. Now, and you can expand this out. When you have IP audio and you have decent connectivity from site to site, and the question asked a lot is, well, what kind of decent connectivity do you need? The basic answer is if you want to do IP audio streaming between sites, you need 5 megabits per stream. So if you want to have three active streams from site to site, you'd have to have a 15 meg link between the two. And people, that's horrible. But with an STL, like a microwave STL link, you could easily get 20 or 50 meg, no issues at all. So really what it depends on is your connectivity between your sites, your line of sight between your sites. I mean, you know all these questions already. But there are people out there in the world who have Wheatnet and Axia systems bridged between multiple sites. And this applies in our world, too, with these RDP sessions. You could have a server at site A being attached to via an RDP session at site B, originating an audio stream or routing an audio stream from site C to site A to come out of site B, all because of WAN interconnectivity between the different sites. So really, everything is not just everywhere within a single studio facility anymore. If you have decent enough site-to-site connectivity, everything is everywhere at all multiple facilities at the same time. That applies to backing up content as well. You can have multiple server pairs at multiple sites backing up your data from one to another. And that way you could run, if site A, the servers both die, you have a fire, whatever, you could run everything for site A from site B because it's all backed up there and your IP connectivity still exists to get out to the STL link to the transmitter site for site A. So really you could run everything everywhere internally. Our software, along with almost all the major components inside these things, have SNMP hooks as well. So you can monitor all this from a central point and be notified if site B's workstation 4 session goes down, or it has the wrong playlist loaded, or the wrong version of our software is running, or the backup software stops running, or take your pick. A port on an Ethernet device goes away. All those have SNMP hooks that can be monitored from a central point. And again, you can access anything from anywhere. So anywhere you can get a RDP session or a VNC type connectivity, remote connectivity back into the system going, you can access any piece of this system from anywhere in the world, essentially, at that point. So our version of this is called ENCO 1. If you'd like to see people smarter than me talking about how this is all actually physically set up and whatnot, we have some videos from NAV at our website, enco.com/enco1. They go into a little more greater detail about the actual interconnects between the servers and whatnot and what it all does. You can see all that information there on our website. Questions? I'll leave that up. It's a lot of information, and I talk fast because I only have 45 minutes. Yes? There we go.
Hi.
Hello.
You say you need 5 megabits per connection, so you know your example of 3, you need 15 from site A to site B.
Right.
The audio stream is obviously not using 5 megabits. Is that for the RDP?
The 5 megabits is for the audio. That's a requirement for, in the Wheatnet world, I know specifically, they need 5 megabits per stream, and it's not for a single stream. It's to have a site-to-site interconnect, so you can initiate a route from A to B, you have to have a 5 megabit connection. I don't know what the exact requirement is for Axia. Anyone know offhand?
They only offer 100 megabits, so it can't be that big. Wheatnet does gigabit on their systems.
Right.
So do the math on that real quick. You can only have 20 workstations on any given single link.
Yeah. If you did 100 meg. That's why they do it.
Which, like I said, Axia is only offering 100.
Right. So. Okay. I don't know offhand what the site-to-site connectivity requirement is for Axia. I just happened to do the same presentation Friday in Orlando, and Jay Tyler was in the back, and he raised his hand and said, you need 5 megabits to connect site-to-site for per stream for Wheatstone. So, yes?
What kind of audio IOs do you use to go from the IP to the actual real-world audio?
Either XLR or RJ45 coming out of, it depends on your system. If you want to use Axia, they're all XLR. Either analog or AES, and if they're Wheatnet, it's going to be RJ45s, again, analog or AES, and both of them have mixed nodes as well.
So you showed the two space rack units there. I mean, you're reducing the footprint, but
right.
Where in your diagram, or where did you show the audio outputs? I mean, what kind of hardware are you
doing? Do you have an existing
that?
IP audio environment or no?
Not right now.
Okay, so if you needed, let's say you need 16 by 16 to accommodate 5 workstations with its environment, you need 2 more rack units worth of gear. You need 2 1U nodes or blades, either from Wheatstone or Axia, to accommodate that. Generally, what you specify is 8 by 8 equals 1 rack unit worth of space, and you can share those amongst the machines. So if you had 10 machines and accommodate 4 by 4 on each, you need 40 by 40, so you need an additional 5 rack units worth of gear to accommodate 40 by 40 AES analog mixed within a IP audio environment. Is that what you're looking for? All right. This fine gentleman right here has a question.
I'm curious about the licensing structure.
Yep.
With the clients and the seats.
It's per seat. It's just server is a seat, everywhere other workstation or whatnot is a seat, and to accommodate the hardware and software and everything within there, it's our price is $8,000 a seat, but that's for everything. Software, hardware, IP audio licensing, thin clients, our licensing, the server licensing, the workstation licensing, everything. It's $8,000 a seat. And we haven't done it less than 4 because it makes absolutely no sense. And even at that point, it's kind of expensive. It starts to make sense at around 10 seats for people that are looking at newer automation systems. And you can intermix traditional with this as well. Just so you know, you can, if you have a studio where you just want to throw a mid-tower and a really cheap production PC into it, I mean, it can attach to this thing just like it's a regular server. It doesn't have to be completely virtualized. Yep. He's coming, right there.
All right. MPEG conversion has traditionally been handled best on the audio card.
Yep.
So in the server environment, how to talk about that?
We have a DirectX compatible codec, which using the Fraunhofer MP2 codec, which will do it in software. And we've been doing that for many, many years with like AudioScience 5000 series cards, VX series cards from Digigram, Sound Blaster clones. It's doing an MP2 or MP3 conversion right in software itself.
And that's working out okay.
Yeah, I mean, we've been doing it since Pentium 3 days.
Yeah,
with the processors that are out there now. It's what to be completely transparent on this, the one thing you lose in this system is matching pitch shifting for stretch and shrink. And what does that mean? Well, if you pitch up all of your audio 103%, it's going to sound pitched up 3%. Instead of with a DSP-based sound card, like an AudioScience 6000 series sound card or a Digigram PCX series sound card, it does a matching pitch shift so that it plays it faster and it pitches it down so it sounds as it was originally produced. And that's a drawback with any IP audio system. If you take the audio cards out of the system, I'm not aware of any software manufacturer that has overcome that. You lose that ability. Until AudioScience came out with their driver includes a componentry from 25.7 that allows for a matching pitch shift in an IP audio driver. So AudioScience actually makes an Axia IP audio driver that does pitch shifting. It's not supported by anybody yet. They're advertising it out there in the real world. We tested it before NAB. We acknowledge that, yes, it does exist. It's just we don't have 100% support for it yet. But it's possible, and it'll be by NAB next year, everybody will be sorting that. So even that will be taken out of the mix as of NAB next year. That'll all be software-based for MPEG and pitch shifting and all that. They say up to 20%, which I think is higher than most people would ever go behind you.
Another one real quick about cost.
Yep.
Versus, say, apples to apples, a 10-seat Enco system, traditional workstation server.
This is about 30% more.
30% more?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, our average cost per seat now, if you're just to do workstations and sound cards, and it varies pretty wildly because a sound card can be $3,700 and a sound card can be $200. You know, so that's the biggest piece of what makes workstations. And workstations can be $2,500 and workstations can be $500. So it's really hard to say a baseline, it's a one-to-one. And it's not really, because the componentry and whatnot is much higher end here, but about 30% more. You know, our average cost per seat, if you did a whole thing with an on-site and everything, is around $6,000-ish with high-end sound cards and workstations and whatnot. Obviously, we can do cheaper versions of that. And more expensive, too, if you have more money. But, you know, about 30% difference. That's where you have to come into play with figuring out how much cheaper it is to install the power loads, the HVAC, the KVM things that you're replacing, the stuff that doesn't come from us. Is what you have to consider when you're doing that in the long-term cost of ownership. Yes. All right. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association. I appreciate it.